Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab. Our topic today is...
Who are you, is what we're asking.
Yeah.
We're asking it in as fundamental a way as we can. Who are you?
You might call it knowing the other.
Pretty good. Very nice. Very nice.
Know,
could
it
be a scholarly journal thing.
Anthropological or something.
All right, let's make it less anthropological because we're going to throw away the anthro part.
Yeah.
So instead of asking it of another person, which we did in the previous section...
Mm-hmm.
Let's ask it, just to make things more interesting, let's ask it of an individual from another species.
Yes, that's where this whole knowing another being's mind question gets way trickier, especially with primates.
Mm.
This next story comes from a reporter, Ben Calhoun, and grew out of a conversation that he had with a, well, just listen.
Okay, you can start anytime you want.
All right, thank you very much, sir.
You ready to go, are you?
Yeah, absolutely. Jerry, you ready?
Yes, sir, whenever you are.
Let's just start with having you introduce yourself.
Well, I'm Jerry Stones. I'm the facilities director at the Gladys Porter Zoo.
That's where Jerry is now, but he told me this story. He was working at the Henry Dorley Zoo in Nebraska, and he was working with this orangutan named Fu Manchu.
I call him Fu. Everybody that loved that old boy referred to him as Foo or Fooey.
Wait, let me just set the scene. So we're in the Nebraska Zoo. Where in Nebraska is this?
In Omaha.
Oh, in Omaha. Okay.
So in the Omaha Zoo, it's fall.
1967, late 66 or 67.
Kind of cold.
Mm-hmm.
The leaves have fallen off the trees. Jerry Stones is just going about his daily business.
What is his daily business?
Being in charge of the zookeepers. So he's kind of the top dog among the crew of zookeepers there. And he's up at the office.
And all of a sudden, here come a couple of the keepers running up over this hill. He says, Jerry, the orangutans are in the trees by the elephant building. My mind went dead for a minute because I couldn't figure out what the blazes they were talking about. And I said, what? And they said, the orangs are in the trees by the elephant building.
So the orangutans are no longer in their assigned area.
Yes.
So I took off with them. We ran down there. And sure enough, there was this grove of elm trees on this hill overlooking the elephant building. And there, up in the top of these trees, were all the orangutans.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
And there was a Fu Manchu and his female Tondaleo and an old female named Sophie, a big, heavyset girl, and a Toba, a young female, and Dennis, a young male. And they were all up in the trees.
Five of them.
Five of them up there, you know. Looked like these huge red... clumps of grapes.
At this point, Jerry's a young guy, so he went Tarzan on him.
Back in those days, I didn't think anything about going to the top of a tree and grabbing an orang by the hand and leading him back out of the tree, even though a couple of them had already bit me.
So he gets them all back in the exhibit,
mm-hmm.
And they didn't know how the orangutans had gotten out.
No, I'm questioning everybody and not listening. I have a tendency to do that, you know. Anyway, we get them down to the building, we put them away in the cage, and we go out to see what was going on. And in the exhibit itself, there's moats on each side of this exhibit.
You know, like a zoo moat.
Yeah.
You've got the exhibit, and then you've got where people look from, and in between, there's a moat.
Right.
Well, down at the bottom of this moat, there was a door to a furnace room.
Big metal door that had just a regular lock and everything on it.
It was always shut.
Kept locked all the time.
That door was open.
What had happened, the orangs had climbed down in a moat, went into the furnace room, which was in the basement, up a ladder to the janitor's closet on the first floor.
One, two, three, four, five. They all emerged from this janitor's closet.
And then just pushed the big glass doors open and went out into the park. I figured somebody had not locked the door shut.
Oh, right. Okay.
So... Jerry Stones gathers his zookeepers around, and he says...
Basically, we needed to be more careful. Somebody evidently went out in that moat to do something, and when they came back in, they did not lock the door. A mistake, and it should not happen again. And everybody vowed that this would not happen again, and it didn't. Didn't happen again for about a week.
A few days go by.
I can't remember where I was at.
And again.
The orangutans, they're in the trees by the elephant building. And Jerry, the door was locked, Jerry. We didn't do it, you know, on and on and on.
So they take them all back into the building.
Same thing, I get there, go down to moat.
That furnace room door is open again.
I was convinced that these people were not sharp enough to tie their shoes, you know, and they said, but Jerry, we don't go down there. Well, somebody screwed up, so I'm discussing with these keepers what's going to happen to them in their short lives. And I swore to God, I said, dude, look, next time this happens, somebody's being fired. A few days later.
Somebody runs up to him.
Jerry, come.
You got to come see this.
I was going, no, not now.
They ran out into the zoo. And they went to this hill that's near the exhibit, peeked over the top of it, commando style. Down at the bottom of the moat, Fu Manchu was messing with that furnace room door.
What was he doing?
They couldn't exactly see what he was doing because of how far away they were, but he was fiddling with the lock. And he's fiddling and he's fiddling, and then...
all of a sudden the door opened.
Bam.
Just popped open, and we went boiling down the hill, and we caught him before he could do any damage.
You mean the orangutan seemed to be opening the door?
Yes.
You know, I realize now it wasn't their fault, and, you know, I ate the crow that I had to eat. And we still didn't know exactly how he did it. And we went out there, and we looked around, and there was a few little sticks and stuff laying around. We thought, well, he must be using this stuff to pry the door open or do something, you know.
So Jerry figured, easy solution. Clean the exhibit every day.
I said, look, from now on, we need to go out in this yard every day before we put the rings up and search that place over and again. You know, make sure there's no sticks or anything out there, because I don't know how he did it, but he did it. You know, we knew what the problem was and we knew how to deal with it. Went along like that for a week or two, and then here come the keepers. Jerry, the orangutans are in the trees by the elephant building. And we checked it, Jerry. We did everything we were supposed to do. Yeah, you know, they're bound and determined. They didn't do anything wrong. So we went down.
So they had been searching this exhibit every day,
yes,
to make sure that he didn't have
anything.
There
was no, we walked that exhibit. We cleaned them up. We did everything. There was no sticks, no anything we could find that he used to pry the darn door open.
No tools.
No tools. No nothing.
Wait, are we now like, how can this be?
How can this be? So he's ushering Fu Manchu through the building. They've got all the orangutans. They're moving them. And all of a sudden, he sees in the corner of Fu Manchu's mouth.
I saw this little blink of light.
Just a little glimmer of light.
Like a silver filling or something?
Yeah.
A little shiny thing at the corner of his mouth.
He walks over, pulls down Fu Manchu's lip, and in there...
lo and behold, there was a piece of wire about 4 inches long that he had bent into a horseshoe to fit inside of his lower lip and around his gum.
And he's had it there for so long
that it was just polished shiny.
Suggesting what? That this animal has been secreting his actual key all this time?
Yeah.
All this stuff that we're picking up and hauling away to keep him from opening the door was of no use because he was carrying his own key with him all the time.
What he had done was stick the wire into the space between the door jamb and the door, wrap it around the latch, and pull it back. It's like,
whoa,
the credit card trick, you know,
yeah,
from the movies.
Yeah.
Nobody taught him this. Nobody ever did anything like that around him. Not only did he make the tool, but he put it in a place where I couldn't find it. He was smart enough to know that if I found it, I'd take it away from him. The Locksmith Union of the United States gave him an honorary membership, and the zoo in Omaha had that hanging on their wall for years. I don't know if they still have it or not.
Well, this has been very interesting. It's a really great story.
Oh, thanks.
Ben. Very nice. But I don't quite understand. Like, what exactly was it? Why are you telling it to me? What is the reason for this?
Well, you know, there's a lot of stories of orangutans using tools, right?
Yeah.
But even though this is a funny story, there's actually a really serious question at the heart of it about deception.
Why? What's so important about it?
Well, deception is special. It requires that the deceiver get into the mind of the person who they're deceiving. And nobody has been able to prove that animals can actually do this, know a human being's thoughts intimately enough, get inside their heads and, you know, consciously deceive them. So I took the Fu Manchu story to a scientist, a primatologist named Rob Shoemaker.
Hello, Rob Shoemaker.
Hey, Rob. It's Ben. Am I catching you?
He's at the Great Ape Trust in Iowa.
And I study the behavior and cognition of orangutans.
And he says the Fu Manchu story doesn't prove that animals are capable of doing this.
Well, in this particular case, I can't prove it one way or another. There's always a question of whether or not it was really happening.
But when I really pushed
him... I'm just wondering, like, personally, do you believe in his case that it was?
He said...
You know, if I had to just give an opinion about this...
That deep down?
I have no doubt at all. I 100% believe it was deception. Keeping a tool concealed over a whole number of days and timing his escapes so that no one was around to see him, I think the evidence is just absolutely compelling to suggest that Fu Manchu was able to deceive and was deceiving. And if someone really has that much trouble believing it, I think then maybe they ought to question, is it because I don't believe what I'm hearing, or I don't want to believe it because it's an orangutan? If they don't want to believe it because it's an orangutan, that's no excuse.
It was like, who taught him? I couldn't figure out. I mean, when you think you're so smart that all the other animals are way below you, and all of a sudden you find this animal that does these sort of things, and you know people that couldn't open the door with a key, right there, you know, you have to be in awe. I've been around a lot of other orangutans in my almost 45 years in this business, and next time you go to a zoo, and you're around one, you just look at their face, and you look at their eyes, and you can see in there, there's this, these wheels turning, trying to figure you out.
Thanks to reporter Ben Calhoun. Okay, to keep things moving, you could say that the last story we heard, you know, that was sort of a formal relationship because you had a orangutan and a zookeeper and they were separated by bars.
Yeah.
But how about this? For this next segment, let's remove the bars, collapse the space, and make it more of a family thing.
Yeah.
More intimate.
So this time, the human will be our producer, Lulu Miller. And this is a tale which leaves Lulu wondering. Something happened to her dog, and the question for her is, can she ever know what happened in her dog's mind? And more important in this case, does she want to know?
On most of his birthdays, Maureen would give Charlie a sweater. Maureen was my dad's coworker. Charlie was my dog. He was a little white terrier, a very active little guy, always snuffling around at something, barking, growling if you took his spot on the couch. But when we'd zip him into that year's sweater, he'd go completely still. Every time, almost like it was an instinct. He'd get that same stillness when my sisters and I would sit in a circle around him, coloring on his white fur with magic markers. I used to think he was still like that because he was happy. Content to be our little dog. But now, I don't know. Wildness glimmered up in him, though, from time to time. We'd be sitting in the living room, Charlie and I, all quiet, late afternoon. I'd be reading a calculus book, or staring at it, kind of, and he'd be gazing out the window, fixed. When suddenly, without warning, he'd tear off to the front hallway, barking, and literally slam his body against the door, not even bothering to scratch. And this urgency was so refreshing, so reassuring, that I'd let him out. And into the street he'd fly, into our neighbor's yard chasing after a squirrel. He'd make it to the base of a far-off tree in 5 seconds flat. Though he never caught a squirrel, or a chipmunk, or anything. Not once. In those moments, though, you could see the wolf inside him, springing to life, this ghost of what he once was. It's just that he was generations out of practice. And this wildness would get misdirected at non-wild things, too. He'd chase after vacuum cleaners, growl at bongo drums, and suspiciously eye the dishwasher. He was part of our family, though, and if I make him sound growly and awful, he wasn't.
He was quiet mostly, stoic, a good listener. My dad's only friend through long stretches. My dad's a guy prone to the nostalgic and swoops of sadness, and I'd stumble in on him on early mornings, in tender conversation with Charlie, testing ideas out on him. "What do you think, big guy?" he'd say. "What do you think?" I imagined he was very lonely. Charlie, that is. Lost in a purgatory where he didn't belong. Okay, congratulations. You've made it this far in someone else's pet story. I promise, things are about to change. Because it's shortly after his 13th birthday. Maureen, I think, got him a little blue jean jacket with a sheepskin inside and Levi buttons. That Charlie got eaten by a pack of wild coyotes. Let me back up, just a step or two. This all happened on Cape Cod, the easternmost tail of Massachusetts, where you can find beachgoers in the summer, Kennedy's, I think, if you know where to look, and very few predators. A couple hawks, the occasional fox. But other than that, as the local fauna goes, it's pretty much Snow White land. Chipmunks, bunnies, skunks. Until the coyotes came. I was about 15 when we first started hearing about them, and for us East Coasters, it made no sense. Coyotes were symbols of the West, somewhere far, far away from Massachusetts, somewhere where the land was orange and wide and open. At that point, the only coyotes I'd ever seen were the ones on ladies' vests in the stores my mom liked. So I looked into it, and it turns out that for a long time it was that way. Coyotes, like big states and cheerful personalities, was a strictly Western thing. But in the 1920s, people started spotting coyotes in New York, and by the late 50s, they'd made it up to Massachusetts. Only, they couldn't quite get out to Cape Cod. See, Cape Cod is literally cut off from the rest of Massachusetts by a canal that's almost 2 football fields wide. So for decades, the coyotes were kept on the mainland. Until one night, sometime in the late 70s, according to naturalists, a pack of coyotes decided to do what the rest of us do. They gathered up their kids together for a road trip and crossed the bridge. Or possibly, some speculate, swam across the canal. But I think it's a far better image to picture them as silhouettes, walking in single file across the bridge with a big white moon behind them. Arr! So, suddenly they were there, and they started multiplying. More and more sightings of them in backyards and on runners' routes. The local press started running articles, "Keep your pets in after dark." A cave was found, local lore has it, with hundreds of collars. In 1998, a 3-year-old boy was bitten. And then, my sister found a goose, completely slaughtered, down on a dock by the pond. It was surrounded by a splatter painting of feces strewn so wide, she deemed it the of terror. Now, it turns out my family came to Cape Cod right around the same time as the coyotes. In the late 70s, my parents bought a cabin in the woods that overlooked a purple marsh. The cabin had a deck, and that's where we spent most of our time. We'd sit out there late into the night, watching birds, then stars. And that's where Charlie was the happiest, on the deck. He'd pace around occasionally, nails scraping the wood. But mostly he'd just flop down with a sigh, a literal human sigh, and gaze out along with us. We never needed a fence, because he simply never left. When the coyotes first showed up, I used to like hearing them. You'd hear it as you lay awake in bed, the howls sometimes far off, sometimes right up close. And it felt thrilling to know that things were happening. Life cycles in grisly nature, predators, prey, right outside the walls. It used to make me feel like part of the earth. So, here's how it happened, from my perspective. It's late August. Sun is setting. We pull into the driveway, but we don't see Charlie on the deck. Immediately, I knew something was wrong. My dad said, "No way, everything's fine." But then we heard a whimper off in the woods. My mom and sisters and I jumped into action. We called for him, shone flashlights. "Charlie!" But the woods had gone quiet. And I remember this part very clearly. We were all standing out on the deck, craning our necks, listening for something. And just as my dad was forming the words, "Look, there's nothing to worry about. He'll turn up in the morning," we heard the yelp. So Charlie, that same noise he'd make when you stepped on his tail. followed immediately by the howls. I ran into a closet to hide from the sound. The next morning, there was nothing. Not a shred, not a collar, not a bone, not a piece of hair. They say one way the coyotes do it, especially with other dogs, is that a lone coyote comes up to the dog and starts playing with it. Eventually, they go off together, and after just a few paces, the pack descends. Or, a slight variation, a coyote pretends to be hurt. It whimpers and cries and calls out for help. I can only imagine Charlie in that moment. There he is, standing face to face with his past self. At long last, one of his own has come over to him. I imagine his head looked up a bit, his chest swelled, his ears perked up, and he stepped off the deck. It's right around then that we would have come home. He would have heard us roll into the driveway, seen our flashlights, heard our calls, and for once, ignored us. He was off to help his brother. I wonder how fast it happened. I wonder if he even knew. I imagine he did. I imagine he saw the eyes suddenly, all at once, realizing he was surrounded, and thought, I've been had. Well played, my brothers. Well played. And I like to imagine a nod of respect on their part before they descended. The morning after it happened, we were empty. My dad couldn't look up. He kept rearranging chairs around the kitchen table as if some new arrangement would obscure the empty spot on the floor. And for so long, that's how we experienced it. It was about us, the family member we lacked. And then one day, years later, it dawned on my sister that for all the sadness we felt, that last moment for Charlie was probably glory. For that one moment, he was wild. He went out like a wild dog. We were all standing out on the deck when she said it. My mom smiled and said, yeah, that's a nice thought. But then she turned to us. You know, who's to say they got him? Who's to say he didn't off and join the pack?
Producer Lulu Miller.
And we'll be right back.
Wait, before we jet, you know, be sure to check out radiolab.org. You can sign up for our podcast there and read all kinds of stuff, as well as see a ridiculously cute picture of Charlie, little Charlie, the white dog. He's on our website, radiolab.org.
You have three new messages. Message one.
Hi, this is Rob Shoemaker, and support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
Message two.
Jerry Stones with the Gladys Porter Zoo. Support for NPR comes from the William T. Grant Foundation. The William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people online at WTGrantFoundation.org. And
three.
The Pew Charitable Trust, whose financial reform project provides analysis to guide the debate over financial modernization, at pewtrust.org.
Four.
This is NPR.
End of message.